So yeah, do you want to get started, Lucy and Thomas?
So I think I'll start, and we'll midway we'll switch speakers. I'll start with the overview of our project. So this is the title is Prototype Monitoring, Reporting, and Verification System for the Regional Scale, the Boston DC Corridor. So the picture on the first slide sort of shows the basic observational database we're relying on for this project. And so it builds on previous projects that had established a fairly dense set of measurements in the Boston area itself. So those are in green, the Boston network. And then we brought in Earth Networks as a team member. So they are providing basically all the purple dots are their greenhouse gas towers in that corridor area. And then there's we also note the NOAA tower there, and missing from that picture is two sites for NOAA aircraft flights that are conducted fairly regularly, which will also feed into our analysis. And then overlaid there as well the OCO tracks, which is, of course, still in the future, but hopefully will become available in time to actually be used in this project as well. So that sort of gives the overview of the observational network and our, you know, geographic focus area. And so the objective was to use that as essentially a prototype system for downscaling the current NASA CMS Flex product to regional and local scales that we claim are relevant to MRV.
Can you just tell us what, like, for example, Earth Network, are they all working and you have data, or is it still, what's the data set currently coming in?
Yeah, we've gone through a fairly extensive analysis of the data availability and quality, and I don't have the, it's actually looking fairly good. They're coming in, I think, for the towers that are there, they're for the most part all coming in. There were some issues with Earth Network's personnel not always getting access to the sites to regular site visits and so on. But they've done, they have automated calibration procedures and quality control procedures that are working even if there's no site visit. And from what we've been able to tell from analysis of the data is that even though there are some sites that hadn't been visited regularly, that didn't really result in a data loss or not a significant data loss. Now, there's some gaps still there, but situation is actually looking pretty good for as far as the coverage is concerned at this point. I don't have the actual numbers in front of me, so I can't be more quantitative.
Okay, no, I just want, thank you.
Okay. So the approach was that, you know, we were focusing on this corridor because it's a fairly highly densely populated area. It's, you know, it's less than 2% of the land area and contains 17% of the U.S. population. And the different components of our projects were to design this measurement network, develop an atmospheric modeling framework, which consists of a high-resolution transport modeling part, which is Wharf-Stilt. So some of you on the call are, of course, very familiar with that. One thing that's sort of unique to this project is that we've enlisted Sigma Space to provide us with mini MPL data, which is a LIDAR that gets backscatter returns from aerosol, so it helps to characterize a planetary boundary layer depth, and that's an area that's of ongoing research as to how to best use that data. And then the part that Lucy is going to focus on in her part of the talk is the high-resolution CO2 flex model that we'll use as a prior in this. And then, we, as most other people on this call, are a part of the top-down community. So we're trying to improve on the prior flex estimates using our atmospheric concentration measurements. So that's sort of the thumbnail sketch of what the project is about. So on page 2, I list all the team members. So it's a fairly big collection of people and institutions. And I think I mentioned, let's see, who I haven't mentioned yet. So obviously Harvard University is a key player in the Boston network, and Steve is also sort of heading up the whole coordination of the measurements, the greenhouse gas measurements part. Lucy will talk about the prior fluxes later. Jim is a collaborator and is going to work with Lucy on her part. I already mentioned Sigma Space, so Earth Networks I mentioned as well. Then Chip Miller is a collaborator, and he will help us out with understanding and using the OCO2 data once it becomes available. And then Crystal Schaff is a collaborator, and she's in charge of one of the instruments in the Boston area. I think I haven't forgotten anybody. So with a caveat that this is certainly incomplete listing of what we've done so far, but I just wanted to give a flavor of the activities of the various aspects of the project that we've done in the first 6 months, basically. One of the things that was a major focus is that, and one of the parts that was part of a proposal is that we were going to have Earth Networks install an additional tower in a location that we preliminarily identified as on Long Island. And so what we did was we looked at all the available towers, really Earth Networks did, since they're familiar with that kind of infrastructure, looked at the possible sites where we could deploy another greenhouse gas sensor. And we from that long list, we called like four candidate sites and did some footprint calculations to see what they would be sampling. And then based on that and logistical considerations, settled on a final site, which is indicated by that red arrow. And so as a frame of reference, I've overlaid that on one of Lucy's maps of traffic-related CO2 emissions that give an idea of where the, you know, major metropolitan centers and traffic corridors are in the New York City area. So that actually has happened. We have now installed the greenhouse gas sensor on a communications tower there, and at the same site also installed one of the mini MPLs so that we can have a sort of direct measurements of planetary boundary height along with the greenhouse gas measurement. So we have an idea of what the sensor is seeing.
And what heights are you measuring at there?
I believe it's at, there's two intake heights, and I think they are 50 and 80 meters, I believe. So it's fairly high.
Okay.
And so what we did before we settled on this final site is on the next slide, slide four, we generated the wharf still footprints. We had already done wharf simulations for a year's worth of data that included the New York City area. So we were able to just quickly run the wharf stilt network and wharf stilt framework and generate footprints. And so I show an example here for the month of March of 2013 for the four candidate sites that we had identified. And then the red arrow is pointing to the one that's closest to the final site. So there is a, let's see, there's a change in scale in one of the plots because the short tower has much larger footprints than the other ones. So that's why that has a different color scale. So the short tower, of course, she sees closer by, the taller towers, the other ones all see further away. And for March, they're pretty much all seeing, you know, the bulk of the metropolitan area of Manhattan Island and areas upstream from there. For a month of July, there's a more of a southwesterly component to the incoming winds, so we're getting some fetch from the metropolitan area, but also some fetch from presumably cleaner air over the harbor and the Atlantic Ocean there. The next slide, slide six, shows the wharf domains we used for the footprint computations for the previous slides there. So this was centered on the Boston area, and that's leveraging work we've done for another area that's focused on methane, the methane budget for the Boston area. So part of what we've done in preparation for the modeling that will be done as part of this project is to more closely analyze the wharf stilt runs, the wharf runs particularly we've done for this study. So we've done some more in-depth evaluation against available National Weather Service data. We are also getting some of the Earth Network's MET data, the so-called weather bug data. So there's a large amount of surface station data available, but it's not particularly quality controlled. So we'll have to be careful in how we actually use it. And we went through an exercise where we looked at some data that was also, it's not part of the Earth Network's data, but was a station that's on top of the MIT tower, and we found out that the wind data was really not representative at all. I think it had to do with how the sensor up there was placed next to some other structures on the roof and so on. So there could be issues with siting and quality control of these data. So we've acquired data for the time period that these wharf simulations were done, and we are also acquiring data in real time going forward so that we have the opportunity to look at them. But it's a little bit still an open question as to how much they will be able to tell us about the quality of the wharf simulations. Another thing we're doing with these wharf simulations is we have a mini MPL already deployed in the Boston area on top of the building of Boston University. So that data is being compared with the wharf simulations of the boundary layer, and analysis of that is going on right now. I think this is mainly what I wanted to say here. So in the next slide, slide 7, I show some sample plots of the type that we use to visualize the wharf verification data. So this is an example where we plotted the bias, so the mean error of temperature and of wind speed when we compare wharf 2-meter winds against the corresponding observations at standard National Weather Service locations. And the station ID is sort of plotted along with these circles, and the color of a circle corresponds to the value of the bias. So one thing to note there is that most stations have a negative temperature bias for this time period, and that's a year-long statistic. And on average, most stations, especially over land, have a positive wind speed bias, and that's actually a fairly well-known issue with the version of wharf we were using for this. And to illustrate that a little further, on slide 8, I'm showing the mean diurnal cycle of observed and predicted temperature and wind speed. So on the left-hand side is for the station KBED, and if you go back to the previous slide, you can see that it's just to the northwest of Boston. It's a suburban airport about 100 feet from where I'm sitting right now. And the other station is KBOS, which is Boston Logan International Airport, which is fairly, you know, close to the urban center, but it's also essentially in the harbor. So that's a sort of a challenging site to model correctly for wharf anyways, because it's right in the boundary of land use types. But the interesting thing there is that the negative temperature bias we were seeing in the previous map there are mostly related to an over-prediction of the nocturnal cooling, which is really indicative of an over-predicted stability of the nocturnal boundary layer. And although I haven't shown that here, when we look at the methane data that we've looked at, especially the ones collected at a fairly low elevation, we're seeing over-predicted methane concentrations at night. So those two things are sort of consistent. So we're sort of are able to use methane data along with the wharf, you know, standard MET verification to indicate issues with the simulation of the nocturnal PVL and wharf. And the other thing is that the wind speed bias we see, the positive wind speed bias we see in Bedford, KBED, it doesn't really depend on the time of day. And similarly, in the one in Boston Logan, we actually had the opposite bias, that the wind speeds are too low compared to observations, probably because the wharf model thinks it's more land-like than it is because it's so close to the harbor. And that, as well, doesn't really depend on the time of day. So I think this is all I sort of meant to show. And well, the one thing I want to sort of mention in this context is that you know, we'll use these results to guide us in designing the next modeling setup. So we'll do some sensitivity tests with different PBL schemes and surface schemes and land use data types that we use in our WRF. And as well, the high wind speed bias will probably be addressed by using a newer version of WRF, which has an improved treatment of that.
What is the resolution you're running WRF at?
Oh, yeah. It's if you go back to slide 6, that has the four domains in it. So the outermost domain is 27 kilometers, and then it's by a factor of 3. So it's 27.93, and the innermost domain is 1 kilometer resolution.
Okay.
And we did use an urban canopy parameterization in the innermost domain.
So 1 kilometer.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. I think unless there are other questions, I'll hand it over to Lucy at this point.
That's what I was going to ask as well, the resolution. And I'll just mention that we did a similar comparison with the weather data in California and also started sort of looking at the Earth Network's weather bug data, but then decided that there were some of these issues with representativeness. And so we ended up just going with the National Weather Service stations.
Yeah, I think that's... I haven't completely given up on it yet, but I think, you know, one certainly has to be careful with non-standard data, even whether it's WeatherBug or other MesoNet data. I've run into similar problems with other MesoNet data as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'll start on, I'll continue from slide 9. And what I was just going to share with you is some of the work that we've done with fluxes coming from the land, from both fossil fuel combustion and biogenic fluxes. So this first slide is showing the results of a new product that we've made for transportation emissions. And transportation emissions are almost 30% of total fossil fuel emissions in the United States. They're also one of the most difficult to spatially allocate, and so that's an arena where we've really targeted a lot of energy. So this map here is showing over that same DC to Boston corridor for the year 2013 what the transportation emissions look like on an annual basis, and this is at a 1 kilometer resolution. With this product that we've generated, we've actually done it annually from 1980. And this is just showing the most recent year. And the blue dots that are displayed there are the locations of in-road automatic traffic automated traffic recorders. So the, you know, strips in the road that you drive over occasionally that are counting both how many vehicles are passing and what their speed is. And we've taken that data, and if you go on to the next slide, slide 10, and I'm going to zoom in on one location here. It's very close to my house, familiar place. I'm probably in that signal that I'm showing. We've taken the annualized data and we've made it hourly. And we've done that using these in-road sensors. So this is one pixel that I'm showing here for a random week in 2013. And you could see the weekend changes in traffic emissions as well as the morning and evening commutes. And so we've spent a good amount of energy. This is one example, but we've also done other sectors to get residential emissions associated with heating and cooling. We've dealt with point sources. Our effort on the point sources hasn't been quite as extensive because that's the uncertainty there is not as large as it is in transportation, for example. But we've been working to come up with higher resolution estimates of fossil fuel emissions as priors into the modeling framework, as well as to just fundamentally get a better handle on where the fossil fuel emissions are coming from. Slide 11 shows an example of ecosystem fluxes, and this is still very much in progress, but what's plotted here, I'll confess, we actually just finished plotting this morning, Jim can attest, as we were emailing with him over the last 24 hours. What's plotted here is zoom in over the Boston area, and the top left panel shows the MODIS continuous vegetation fields, and then the MODIS NPP product, and then the bottom left is a high-resolution estimate of biomass that we created for this region based on direct field measurements as well as remote sensing. And then the bottom right shows the NACP CMS biomass estimates, the 5-kilometer version. And you can see that a lot of the area within the urban portion is masked out in products like the CMS biomass and the MODIS because of mixed pixels. And in these urban areas, the biomass is certainly lower than it is in intact forests, but the biomass is not zero.
Zero.
And so we're starting to work with Jim on making some modifications to this to try to be able to capture the role of that urban vegetation. And the urban vegetation is not likely to be a massive carbon sink, but on a diurnal basis, the fluxes from that vegetation are significant. And some recent work that we're just getting together now is suggesting that on a per-unit biomass, that urban vegetation is actually remarkably productive because it's growing in such a high nitrogen, CO2, and light environment that we're observing about double the productivity per-unit biomass in these urban areas, while the biomass is something like, depending on exactly how urban, something between a half or two-thirds reduced. But in products like the NPP and the current CMS biomass layers, it's just entirely masked out. And I'll show one more slide, just that how that we have
Lucy, I wanted to say that the NACP CMS biomass map is only for forest biomass, not total biomass. And if you look at a U.S. Forest Service map of forest cover type, all those blank places are not reported as having forests on them by that map. So that product was focused completely on forests only, and because of the map that was used, there was nothing there. Now, the standard CASA GFED, which is much coarser at half degree, will have fluxes and biomass for that grid cell. I'm not saying they're going to be right or not, but that area in half degree will have some numbers in it.
Yeah. So that's this is what over the next month's year we'll be working with Jim on trying to refine is be able to more accurately capture the contributions of this urban vegetation to changes in the urban atmospheric mixing ratios of CO2. And I just included one more slide, and this is just the eastern half of Massachusetts, and this is illustrating what Jim was just saying, that there's a lot of areas which have no data because the predominant land use is not forests, but many of those areas do actually have trees on them, which are exchanging carbon. And I just included one last example of what some of these other fluxes look like, and this is, I'm sorry, it's cut off for, includes almost all of the estimate, but this is human respiration that's plotted here. And the pink circles that are shown there are tower locations for the Boston network that we have. And while human respiration doesn't make a very significant impact on a national scale, within these dense urban corridors like D.C. to Boston, it can make a quite significant contribution. And that human respiration contribution is actually on par with ecosystem respiration. So we've been working to try to get estimates of all of these different sources and sinks across this urbanized area. And then I'll let Thomas do the last slide.
Okay, yeah.
Lucy,
so there,
is that just using population data then, Lucy, for the respiration, human respiration?
This particular plot is slightly more sophisticated, just slightly. We took the census population density, the census population data at the finest resolution that is available, as well as a Massachusetts high-resolution land cover map. And so we allocated that population to residential, I should say land use. We allocated population to residential land uses so that the spatial allocation was a little bit more precise, as opposed to just smearing it across an entire census block group, which in some cases where the population is not very large, that can be a large area. But so basically people times an emissions factor for per capita respiration.
Thanks.
Okay, so the last slide, slide 14, I just listed some of the things we're working on next. So one of the areas that Steve's group is spearheading is the intercalibration of the Boston and the Earth Network's sensors. And we'll also be using sort of some kind of time period within the last year to sort of exercise our model analysis framework and have a baseline to compare against the enhanced network, which is the additional sensor. And ongoing is the real-time acquisition, of course, of greenhouse gas and mini MPL data. And I've already mentioned that we'll be conducting more sensitivity studies to come up with one or multiple sort of best configurations for the modeling system. Lucy and Jim are going to be working together on the prior flex models. I think that's all we had for our project.
Yeah, thanks very much. Maybe we can do some questions for 5 or so minutes. One thing I was going to ask is, in terms of the inversion, calculating fluxes throughout your various domains, and then are you also looking at fossil fuel and biospheric fluxes, or just biospheric fluxes?
No, we'll definitely include the fossil fuel fluxes. That's one of the foci, really, because we're concentrating on these urban areas. So.
Okay, and then you'll be calculating it for the whole U.S. or just for your inner domains?
No, we'll be concentrating on inner domain, and we will use a combination of, some of the Earth Network's towers are actually basically in inflow areas, which will allow us to characterize the boundary condition to some extent, and we can also use, existing estimates from coarser flux and concentration models to provide us with boundary conditions. So, of course, that's an area that we'll have to, the uncertainty in those boundary condition values is one of the things that we'll have to account for in the inversion framework.
I guess one difference between our region and your region is that, we're next to the ocean, whereas you have air coming from the continent into your inner domain.
Yeah.
So it makes things a bit more complicated.
One other piece that we didn't mention is the FTS sensors that Steve Wasti's group is also going to be deploying to try to measure total column concentrations as both a validation, verification of what's coming out of Wharf Stilt, but also to link with OCO2.
For the CASA runs over the urbanized areas, is that something that could be extended to other regions, or are you looking very specifically to your area?
I think right now, we're just getting started on this. And I think that we're going to focus probably initially on Boston because that's where we have a lot of high-resolution remote sensing data that we've already processed, as well as field measurements. So I think that we'll start there and then work on the most data-constrained location that we have, and then we'll work on scaling it from there. But we're just getting started on that.
Mm-hmm. Other questions or anything that you wanted to bring forward as discussion points yourselves, Lucy and Thomas?
Thomas, in evaluating the WRF, have you only looked at the NWS surface stations, or have you looked at also the upper air stations?
We've looked at those two, but for the innermost domain, there's just a single station, Chatham, which is over the Cape, so it's not really very representative of the urban area as such, so it doesn't, you know, give that many insights as to what we're really interested in.
Okay.
But it's sort of part of our routine, you know, verification of all the WRF runs that we compared against all available stations.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, well, maybe we can move to Jim and then try and keep some time at the end.
Okay. I'll talk a little bit about my products and then go further to show how we're using atmospheric CO2 observations to try and improve the model. So I call it a case study. So it's sort of, you know, it's MRV. It's not good enough for policy, but hopefully it's good enough to start making improvements, finding model weaknesses and making improvements. CASA is a physiological and fire land global land carbon flux model, the physiology being physiological uptake, photosynthesis, and then heterotrophic respiration and return. And so we're interested in, you know, are the CO2 observations good enough, or how good do they have to be to constrain the fluxes? And my collaborators on this are, my atmospheric collaborators here are Randy Kawa and Leslie Ott. So the first slide is just a summary of the system, the CMS, CASA GFED system. On the upper left, you have the simple diagram of the model and the fluxes between the atmosphere and the biosphere. CASA uses satellite data to prescribe vegetation, phenology, and interannual variability. It is not a dynamic vegetation model. It cannot predict vegetation growth and things like that. So it is constrained by the observations. It also uses vegetation continuous fields, which affects allocation of carbon that's taken up between herbaceous and woody components within a grid cell. It uses the MERA meteorology and it's half degree and monthly at native resolution. Carbon's taken up, it's put into live pools and dead pools. These pools are kept track of, so we have biomass. And the carbon is returned to the atmosphere through respiration and fire that's emitted both from chilled and burned live pools and dead pools. The using the system, then, we can predict fluxes, and there's a map of 2011 July NBP fluxes. NBP is the carbon taken up by the surface out of the atmosphere, so the sign is different than what atmospheric folks use. And includes fire as well as the physiology, so you see strong uptake in the northern latitudes at this time. We have done some uncertainty analysis, some parameter uncertainty analysis based on our experience with the model and based on sensitivity work. We have selected important parameters and applied plausible probability distribution functions on them and then sample them. And then in between, you see this, these little blue lines that just represent Monte Carlo simulations. And it's flat, it flattens out during the spin-up. We spin it up for 250 years from a baseline run. And then there's little squiggles, as you can't see. Those are, that's 1997 through 2011. And there's a map below that shows the, our estimated uncertainties as one sigma for those fluxes in July. So we take the fluxes, the NPP and heterotrophic respiration and fire fluxes, and we disaggregate them into three hourly fluxes during a month, during every month, so that during the month, everything adds up to the monthly value, but it can vary from by three hourly time steps. And we use solar radiation, which is, you know, it's dark at night, so there's no photosynthesis at night, and less photosynthesis on cloudy days than on sunny days. And then we use temperature to modulate respiration in the system, both our assumptions about autotrophic respiration and heterotrophic respiration. So these are fluxes now. They are available on the NACP site and the CMS site for 2003 through 2011. The monthly fluxes are at half degree, and the three hourly fluxes are 1 by 1 1/4 degree, which is the resolution of the transport model that we are using, which is PCTM GEOS 5. So we take these fluxes, we feed them into a transport model, either a forward transport model or Kevin Bowman's or other folks' inversion models. And from an inversion model, then out of that can come maps of sources and sinks, posterior fluxes based on, to some extent, on the priors that we provide. And they also can be used in forward atmospheric transport simulations so that you get maps, time series maps of CO2, three-dimensional CO2. And then these can be used to plan what sorts of sampling is required, or what can various sampling strategies from satellites be applied. And here, this is just a simulation of ascend sampling, LIDAR CO2 sampling with errors, including cloud issues. And, of course, this feeds back, and ultimately from these analyses, we will find out where the strengths and the shortcomings of the model are and improve them so that they're more realistic, so that simulations from the model are more realistic.
Can I actually ask a question?
Yes.
And I just came back from a TCON meeting where there was an overview talk on GOSAT, using GOSAT data to go through this kind of big exercise. And one of the big problems was that, you know, the data, when you put it in a simulation model, gives very physically unrealistic end solutions of posteriors. And one of the concerns is that sampling strategies may be biased. So satellite-based, it's one of the, and I'm not an expert in this, but the core conclusion was that there's a lot of inversion going on to constrain models. But what we could be looking at, satellite-based monitoring could have some systematic biases.
Sure. And I, that's not
is
my...
Is that primarily clear sky or something else?
Well, I don't quite know. This was a pretty serious discussion that there's enough being done that there is some concern there.
There's an interesting paper by Chevalier and Palmer recently that looks into using different versions of GOSAT in different inversions, and it's,
right,
it's kind of troubling, yes.
Yes, yeah, so all I'm saying, you guys should be aware of that as we kind of push that, there's some really fundamental sampling concerns that we need to tackle.
I could also add, I was just at the Transcom meeting the last few days, and so Sander was showing an intercomparison of inversions using GOSAT data, and he was finding that the inversion put more net uptake into the northern extratropics compared to the tropical regions. And so one of the possible explanations is the fact that GOSAT only has summertime data, so maybe missing
right.
the dormant season release in the northern latitudes.
Huh.
So, yeah, I was wondering if that's something that you also found, Jim. Did you, in your posteriors?
Well, the only person, I mean, I don't run inversions. I just supply
yeah.
the stuff, and then they show me the fluxes, and then I try to reconcile what I know about how the biosphere behaves, given the uncertainties on the inversions. The only inversions that person that I've been working with that's using GOSAT is Kevin Bowman. And he's just sort of starting. We don't have a really long time series, and that just hasn't been resolved as to what I've seen some inversions, but they're only for a year and a half and things like that. So it's hard to pick up interannual variability and sinks from that. But I'm waiting for to see stuff from them, and I haven't seen a whole lot yet, just a few maps.
Jim, if I could ask a question with respect to the biosphere model,
mm-hmm.
does it include both forests and cropland?
Yes.
And natural prairies, etc.
It includes, you know, all land surface areas that
okay.
fall within our half degree grid cell. It does not use vegetation map per se. It uses it a little bit, but it's not very important. What it does use is vegetation continuous fields from MODIS, which prescribes for each grid cell the fraction of woody, herbaceous, and bare. And then
okay.
we calculate fluxes for each one of those components and then average them for the pixel. So a crop pixel would be herbaceous. I have tweaked some things. I've put some crops in the Midwest based on crop inventory data, but I do not have a global crop model beyond the Corn Belt.
Very good. That's a great start. Thank you.
So the next slide is the comparison from – go ahead. Somebody ask? Any more? So the next slide, slide 3, shows a latitudinal gradient in weekly flask measurements, which are the red symbols from alert in the north down to the South Pole at various latitudes. These are detrended, so if you look at the red, the slope there says 1.84. So the CO2 at alert is going up by 1.84 ppm per year. Now, CASA does not have sink mechanisms built into it unless there are trends in the climate and trends in FPAR over the time period of these simulations, which, as it turns out, aren't strong enough really to cause any major sink. Well, we don't have CO2 fertilization. We don't have long-term disturbance history recovery from, you know, previous to 97 fires. So harvest and things like that are not in CASA. So if you look at the blue slope, you see CASA is going up by 3.75 ppm per year. Obviously too fast. We did do a simulation where we imposed a sink by increasing NPP every year for 70 years. And this generates about a 3 petagram land sink, and it's proportional to the NPP at every grid cell. So if NPP is high in a grid cell, there's a higher sink. The net effect of doing that is that there's a lot of carbon sink in the tropical forest because their NPP is so high. So we've imposed this on the model, and then if you look in the cyan, the slope now is 1.27, so it's closer to the actual growth rate that's observed. So the dark blue is a baseline run, and the cyan symbols are the sink run. And you see there's marginal, some effects. There's more a bit more amplitude in the sync run, but that it all disappears by the time you get to the South Pole. But the seasonal cycle is pretty well captured. And if you take the next slide...
Have you put the three-paragram sync? Where have you put it most... Where is it?
It's proportional to NPP. So if I showed you a map of global NPP, that would be a map of the sync, scaled. And so two-thirds of the sync are below 30 degrees north.
So it's dominated in the
where,
tropics.
That's where 60 or some percent of the NPP of the globe exists.
Okay.
So in the next slide, I have the mean seasonal amplitude for the period 2003 to 2011 at 38 NOAA surface sites, and the error bars or the represent the variability over that time period for the 7 years. And you see how the distribution of the amplitude and the size of the amplitude are pretty close. There's not a lot of information here that would help us improve the modeled seasonal cycle. We have a little bit too high amplitude north of 60 or 55 or something like that. And in the next slide, this is an example of at WLAF of NOAA continuous measurements where they are making measurements sampling as they're pumping the air through the analyzers. And this is for daily. I'm showing daily fluxes here. And besides the seasonal cycle, what you see are synoptic variability. And what it sort of shows generally is that the transport model is capturing synoptic variability fairly well, not completely, but fairly well. And those parcels of air that are being transported in during the synoptic events are carrying signals, CO2 signals, after passing over different regions, and they seem to be altered by those surfaces in reasonable ways, so that the CO2, when it arrives at WLAF and crosses, it has about the right CO2 concentration. But of course, there's a lot of variability. So the transport model seems to be capturing that variability, and the air parcels seem to be, within reason, have the right CO2 concentration across them, given the errors, of course. Now we've had the surface observations. Now we'll look at an example at TCON WLAF. These are column. The top is the daily fluxes. In this case, daily CO2 variability. The red is the TCON. The green is the sync flux, because you see how the CO2 is tracking the CO2 increase is tracking the observations. And if this were the baseline, it would be flying way off, away and drifting away from the TCON observations. But with the sync imposed, it follows them. And here again, you have synoptic variability. And some of the major events, some of the big events, are in fact captured by the transport model and the surface model. Below, you see the interannual variability and seasonal cycle for monthly means. And so, with a monthly mean, we kind of average out the variability. And you see we capture some of the interannual variability too, but not all of it. 2010, for instance, we have too much drawdown, even though it's less than some other years. In the next slide, these are HIPPO profiles. The top is during spring of 2010, and the lower October and November 2009. The black lines here are the tropopause height of the model. And the left two figures are the observed, reported by HIPPO. The middle is the is CASA GFED 3 with the NOBM ocean model, and then the graph on the right is the differences, and you see differences, and these are presumably in part because of transport issues. I know, as far as I understand from my colleagues, atmospheric colleagues, that vertical transport is an uncertain thing in these models and shows a lot of interannual variability. And I think Tom mentioned how overly stable, for instance, this was an example of how at night the New Wharf was too stable, perhaps. But these are just examples, and there are differences here. So what we have to aim at is try to resolve these and distinguish transport errors from surface errors. The next one example is a GOSAT column estimate. So we have latitude on the y-axis, and from 2009 through 2010 for the various months, showing CO2, the first upper left graph is the GOSAT. The middle is the modeled run, and then the right are the differences. And below that is an attempt to separate two different land models and two different ocean models. They're somewhat different, and whether we can resolve the differences between those models using GOSAT. And so everywhere you don't see a black line, that's where there's a significant difference, where we could resolve the differences between these models. The one on the right is two different ocean models. There's not a grid cell, really, except for down in the southern hemisphere where you can actually tell the difference. But there are time periods and locations where the land models could be distinguished from one another. And then I think I'm close here to the end. Here's some comparisons using inversions, in this case Carbon Tracker. If you look at the globe on the left, that left series of plots, the lower right one shows the global fluxes and uncertainties from COSTA-GFET and from Carbon Tracker, and you see that we have too much respiration in the winter, and that's the sink. COSTA does not have a sink, and so the inversion obviously has to have one. And on the right is looking at interannual variability for the different regions, transcom regions, and we do very poorly on interannual variability, except in places where there's lots of fire, like in boreal Asia and temperate Asia, and perhaps tropical Asia. But everywhere else, we don't do a good job. So we know we don't do a good job in interannual variability, and that's a focus now. And then finally, here's a simulation. Yes? Someone's going to ask something? No. Is a simulation where we included fire and we excluded fire, and we took the difference. And if you look at the surface CO2 concentration, this was a big fire year in August in the Amazon, and the surface generally is less. These fire fluxes on a monthly time scale produce changes in the surface in the model of about less 10 ppm or less. And if you look at the column, these are, of course, diluted and more difficult to see, and they are less than 3 ppm. So it's very hard to see in the column on a monthly average individual fire events in the northern latitudes, and it's only these big fire events that big fire season, places that burn a lot, that we can actually see in the column.
So
yes?
Actually, you can see, I mean, the 3 to 6 ppm signals are resolvable. The problem in the tropics is, at least in the Amazon, is you don't have enough cloud-free days. The cloudiness kills you.
Right, but, but you're going to see under 3, not 3 to 3, under
okay.
3 ppm in the column.
For
places where this is like 2010 was a huge fire year. So this is the best that the model would predict, the biggest signal that the model would predict. Now, can the this is an idealized, so will a satellite column measurement be able to see this because of biases due to clouds and things like that? You know, that's another story, which is not, you know, showing here. I'm just sort of showing that the signals are even the big signals are quite dilute by the time you look at the column, and that's a challenge, I think, for column CO2 observations. So I think that I can finish there.
Yeah, thanks, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jim, let me try to... So, are you saying that with this additional productivity you've added scales, things make a lot of sense? That's the solution, at least to some of these biases you have in the model? Or are there other things? You've done uniform scaling, but, you know, there's this other camp that, you know, the data that, you know, things may have changed at higher latitudes. Yours is a little bit more dominated by lower...
Right.
If, yeah, and that's
we've done some studies where if we put the sink, put 60% of the sink in the northern latitudes instead of the southern latitudes, our amplitudes are going to be way too big. So we would have to decrease our productivity, increase our Q10, or we'd have to change a lot of parameters to get it to work the way the inversions seem to say the sink is there. This sink that we put, where we put 60% below and 40% above 30 north, that's really difficult to see in the column, to tell you the truth. It's really tough because it's smeared out. It is smeared out over all the NPP across all the land surfaces, that three petagrams. And, you know, If the sinks are in fact actually concentrated in specific continents, and so you have, you know, most of this NPP most of this sink in smaller locations, then they'd be easier to see. I know the inversions have a big problem putting the sink in the north or the south, that recent paper by Palin in 2013 that does a comparison of all the inversions. And also, longitudinally, it's very difficult to, with given the uncertainties, to put the sink in Europe or in Asia or in North America, given the observations that are being used in the inversion.
Jim, what, I may have misunderstood, but it sounds as though, if I understood right, your model currently, or custom defense currently, is carbon neutral.
Yes.
What are the prospects for running an inversion with our eco separate from NPP and, you know, letting it adjust those on a regional or, you know, continental scales to allow for sinks?
Scott Denning has a system. I haven't seen a lot out of that, but he had scalers, independent scalers for GPP and ecosystem respiration that he solved for. And there you'd think there would be information. There's diurnal information. There's diurnal variability in those two things. And then there's seasonal variability in those two. Respiration can occur in the winter, but photosynthesis only occurs in the light. So I think theoretically, yeah, it would be possible. It would also be possible perhaps to solve for some scalar which reduces carbon pools, in order to generate a sink. And by reducing the carbon pools, you reduce the respiration.
Got it. Yeah.
And then so you can, and I have a colleague who has done this for eddy covariance sites, where he solved for a parameter that scales the carbon pools down to fit the eddy covariance sinks. So I haven't seen anybody do that yet, but it's another way. Now that deals with perhaps like a disturbance kind of function in a mechanistic way. Now,
yep.
CO2 fertilization is a growth enhancement, but then again, it means that the pools are out of equilibrium with the photosynthesis, so that would, it's sort of the same, you know, it turns out with the same result.
Excellent. I was sort of looking for your judgment on what a promising way to go with CASA GFED would be for introducing flexibility for disequilibrium.
Right. So. We have some information. We do have some stuff about forest age. And we have it for the U.S., and there is some stuff for North America I've seen, and there are maps of forest sinks that are based on inventories, and those could be used to initialize a global model like CASA and would generate spatial distributions in sinks. And we sort of we're thinking about that, but we have not done it.
But and you may also it may also help to get data sets like TCON that you have at WLEF at more productive regions like the Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we are actually going to be having for CO2 validation a TCON in Nauru that hopefully will produce at least 1 year of data set that we could do the same kind of comparisons you've done at WLEF.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the tropics, there's a lot of action in the tropics, and as you might, some of you might remember from the Palin study, there's one set of models that puts a big sink in the tropics. I mean, a physiological sink in the tropics. So after accounting for deforestation and fires. And then there's another set of models that makes the inversions that make the tropics neutral.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and there's a, you know, a plausible, there's a plausible CO2 fertilization sink there, but again, it's not, there's a lot more work to be done. And it'll be important to the models.
So Jim, how do you think that spatial errors and the fossil fuel emissions that are used to drive this fit into your results?
Again, I am not an expert on that, so I'm trusting others. And I think, you know, I think people have looked at what aliasing, you know, what could be done there. There's seasonal variability as well as interannual variability, perhaps, and spatial variability. I'm hoping that the people I work with will quantify that and use the best products they can.
Jim, for the inversion that you introduced at the beginning, are they using your neutral fluxes or the ones with the uptake?
They are scaling it themselves. They are taking, and I think it has basically the same effect. They are using what Chevalier has called a poor man's prior or something, in which they make the prior have a sink that's consistent with the global sink. And I think they distribute it basically according to NPP in kind of a one-shot deal versus what I did, which was a multi-year simulation and increasing NPP every year until I got the map. But, yeah, Bowman is using a scaled CASA GFED 3 as his prior. And it's scaled to have a sink, and I think it's distributed by NPP, so it'll be most strongest in the tropics.
Jim, what do you do about the ocean fluxes?
The stuff I showed you, I think, is using Takahashi, except for the later slides that looked at HIPPO and GOSAT, and those used a Goddard ocean model or compared it to the Eco-Darwin ocean model as well.
All right, so they're prescribed as
yeah.
Just an yeah.
Maybe just a practical question in terms of using the fluxes for our regional inversions. would it be sort of 6 months later that we could get them?
Okay. It usually takes that much time. I am really ready. I'm in a position right now to produce 2013. I have everything I need. I just need to get the time. It usually takes 4 or 5 months because some of the products are based on time series analyses. So you sort of have to have 3 months or so of time before you can generate product 3 months earlier. So it is ready now. And if I were a little faster, I probably could have gotten it out there about three weeks ago or so. But we will be posting it within the next 2 weeks, the 2013.
Okay, and with the uncertainties as well?
No. The uncertainties, I don't think they change a whole lot from year to year.
Okay.
I think once you have the, I mean, we do produce uncertainties for every, actually we have the uncertainties and they're not posted. The uncertainties aren't posted at all yet. But I have them from 1997 every month through 2011. And that's when we've done our Monte Carlo runs. But I don't think the uncertainties change very much significantly from year to year. So once you have that, I think there's so many more uncertainties in the whole thing that using just those that we have. I mean, anyway, until someone can argue that it's really important, which means I have to rerun the Monte Carlo runs. We're gonna see how people are getting along with what we've got.
Jim, does that mean that there is at least one uncertainty estimate for 1 year that is available, or is how would we obtain
I can get you. I've given the stuff to Kevin Bowman, and I can give it to anybody who asks me. And these will be half degree monthly for whatever time period you want.
Very good. Thank you.
Then I was just also going to ask about the outlook. So I think if your current CMS project is developing these fluxes further, I think, is that right? And then
I'm in my second year, and so I have another year.
Okay.
This is something I want to keep doing. So we're trying to make sure that we have funding from various other, in various other ways to keep this going.
Okay. So in terms of sort of the 2014 fluxes,
we'll definitely get 2014 fluxes.
Okay.
Sure.
And they'd be similar to what you've been producing, or they might include some sort of updates or improvements?
It depends on if Jim Randerson's GFED 4 system, which I'm a member of that team, his funding kind of ran out and we're finishing up. We may migrate to GFED 4, which the differences will be it'll be a quarter degree, and we'll have to rerun everything. It'll be a quarter degree, and it will have small fires and understory fires, so the fire emissions are going to go up, and the interannual variability in the fire emissions are going to go up. We see that already. But it's just a matter of keeping that system funded and then producing the code. I'm not the one who's generating that code, but once it's done and we have the burned area data to put in it, and then our plan was to migrate in the next year to GFED 4.
Okay. Yeah, any other comments? I guess we're about 15 minutes over an hour. So we could wrap up.
Well, thanks for hanging in there.
No, it was great.
Questions for next... Heather, the next telecon is July 30th or June 30th?
Yeah, so we can plan for July 30th
okay,
for the next
good.
Telecon, so also Wednesday at 10 Pacific.
Yeah,
and we can email. Actually, I forgot to mention there's an option on the conference call to record the call. So I activated that. I hope that's okay with everyone. Then we can at least have a record if we wanted to refer back. So anyway, you can let me know if you don't want a record and I can delete it. But otherwise, we'll have a recording of the call. Yeah, so I'll just be in touch by email. And yeah, it was great to get the discussion going. And since there's a lot of overlap between the groups.
And did anybody else call in who later? I think there were a few other people who called in.
I think I heard
Ralph. Ralph, I'm a bit late.
Yeah.